why there is concern over the leaks in the Nord Stream pipelines.
Many analysts are taking this, you know, saying that if Russia is behind this, and that remains an if, then this is a warning to the West that, you know, your energy infrastructure is vulnerable.
Plus, analysts speaking to VOA share their thoughts on Russia's battlefield losses and Russian President Vladimir Putin's recent announcements.
I think he could read very clearly that the long-term trends were not in Russia's favor, and he felt that he had to do something in order to stem the tide in this war.
And later in the program, how four-legged friends are helping Ukrainian veterans. Today is Wednesday, September 28th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. The Kremlin on Wednesday said that claims that Russia was behind an attack on the Nord Stream gas pipelines were stupid, adding that Moscow contends that there was a sharp increase in the profits of U.S. companies supplying gas to Europe. Europe has been investigating what Germany, Denmark, and Sweden said were attacks that caused major leaks into the Baltic Sea from two Russian gas pipelines at the center of an energy standoff. Joining us with more details is VOA's Henry Ridgewell in London. Henry, I wanted to ask you, you know, there have been these allegations that the Nord Stream pipelines were sabotage, and several governments are looking into the cause of this leak. What's been shared thus far as to the results of these preliminary investigations?
From my understanding, the investigations are difficult at this stage because of the volume of gas simply that's leaking from these pipelines. If you look at the pictures and the video that is coming from that area, the bubbles and the disruption to the ocean is huge, and ships have been warned to avoid the area around Bornholm Island. That's a Danish island in the Baltic Sea where the damage has taken place. So the Germans have sent naval vessels to the region. The Danish military is also there, but I think they have to wait until the pressure in the pipelines drops and until the bubbling gas escapes to the ocean surface before they can do much more investigation at the pipes themselves where the leaks are taking place. Now, having said that, there are some unofficial evidence, if you like, from other players. A seismologist from Sweden shared his evidence yesterday that showed two big explosions exactly where these ruptured pipes have taken place, suggesting, he said, that explosives, something like over 100 kilograms of TNT, were used to sabotage the pipeline. Now, that's certainly the line that the EU is taking, that this is sabotage, and the investigations are proceeding along that route. It hasn't named any guilty party yet or accused anyone. Ukraine has said that Russia is to blame for this and calls it a terrorist attack. But I think it's going to take several days before we get any more evidence about who's behind this.
Henry, you mentioned the explosions that were picked up by the seismologist. Russia has denied it is responsible for these leaks. But can you kind of explain, you know, what we know about the explosion, what we know about what caused the leak at this early stage? Because you mentioned these are a tremendous amount of bubbles that are reaching the surface, and the pipelines had pretty much been turned off in terms of transferring gas to Europe.
Right. So there's two pipelines there. There's Nord Stream 1. Which is in fact two pipeline parallel pipelines. It's been open for several years now. Now, that was shut down in August. Russia said it was shutting it down for maintenance reasons. The EU accused Russia of weaponizing gas and cutting off supplies because of EU sanctions on Russia following the Ukrainian invasion. Then there's Nord Stream 2, which ran very close to Nord Stream 1. That was completed earlier in the year. And then the German government pulled the plug on that project, and it has never actually delivered any gas to Germany. But both of those sets of pipelines were pressurized. And so when the explosions have taken place, these pipelines are something like 1,200 kilometers long. They run along the floor of the Baltic Sea. So you can imagine the volume of gas that is contained in that 1,200 kilometers. These are large pipelines. So that's why it's taking time for the gas to emerge and to leak out. The first news we had came on Monday afternoon when the operators of Nord Stream 2 reported that they had a loss of pressure. And then on Tuesday, the operators of Nord Stream 1 said that they had also lost pressure and suffered unprecedented damage. And so therefore, the inevitable conclusion, so the investigators say, is that this must be sabotage, because you would not get damage of this scale to two separate pipelines without any earthquake, without any seismic activity, of which none was recorded. These pipes are made of thick steel, coated in several centimeters of hardened concrete as well. So they're designed to withstand earthquakes. So it would have taken quite an impact, quite an explosion to damage them to this level.
Henry, has there been discussion on what the potential impact these leaks may have? Because, as I mentioned, Europe was already in the process of weaning itself off of Russian hydrocarbons.
In terms of the Russian market, if you look at how the gas markets, the energy markets have reacted, there has been around a 10% rise in the spot market price for gas since the gas leaks took place earlier this week. Now, that might sound like a lot, but given the huge changes in the gas market, we've seen a roller coaster ride really over the recent months. Compared to that, that isn't a really big rise. So I think the market reaction is such that they understand that Europe is being quite successful in rapidly weaning itself off of Russian hydrocarbons with the help of the United States, for example, with liquefied natural gas imports, further import pipeline imports from other countries, including Algeria and Norway. It's worth mentioning, though, that these explosions took place on the very day that a new pipeline opened running from Norway to Poland. In fact, the two pipelines cross in the Baltic, and the attacks aren't far from where that Norway to Poland pipeline lies, too. So many analysts are taking this, you know, saying that if Russia is behind this, and that remains an if, then this is a warning to the West that, you know, your energy infrastructure is vulnerable and we have the ability and the technology to attack it. There are some reports that in years past, explosives attached to underwater drones have been found close to pipelines in the Baltic. Those are unconfirmed, but that's the kind of attack technology that many people fear makes Europe very vulnerable to this. So there are two elements to this. There's the Russian gas market and the future of Russian energy supplies to Europe, which Europe is managing to wean itself off, albeit slowly. But then there's the element of vulnerability of European energy supplies that could be open to attack by a bad actor, if you like. And so those are two considerations that Europe is having to take very seriously going forward.
From London, England, Henry Ridgewell. Henry, thank you very much for your time.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Russian-installed officials in four occupied regions of Ukraine reported huge majorities of votes in favor of joining Russia. That's something that the West condemns as a sham. Reuters' Jason Albano continues our coverage.
Russian-installed officials in Ukraine's Donetsk region declared victory late Tuesday after the results of a hasty vote there pointed towards joining Russia. Donetsk is one of four occupied regions of Ukraine where 5 days of voting has taken place. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia wasn't even trying to hide it.
This farce in the occupied territories cannot even be called an imitation of a referendum. What would be proclaimed as results were known beforehand. Even the intelligence community didn't have to put too much effort into it. The agreed-upon figures for this farce were leaked to the media. Russia is blatant about it.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said they were planning to introduce a resolution to the body in the coming days.
So we are putting forward a resolution with Albania that condemns the sham referenda, calls on all states to not recognize any altered status of Ukraine, and obligates Russia to withdraw its troops from Ukraine immediately.
Merci, Monsieur le Président.
Thank you, President. Russia's ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, however, dismissed the accusations and said the referendums were conducted transparently and in line with electoral norms.
More than 100 independent international observers observed it from 40 countries. They actively put their opinions in the media, and they were particularly surprised by the enthusiasm of the people and how enthusiastic they were about the referendum and how long they had waited to hear this. Unfortunately, you won't hear this.
The regions that stand to be annexed make up about 15% of Ukrainian territory altogether. Kyiv says it will press on with plans to retake all territory occupied by invading forces. One senior Russian official said annexation could come as early as next week.
Jason Albano reports for Reuters News. And be sure to visit voanews.com/flashpoints for updates on the war throughout the day. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Moscow said Wednesday that training for newly mobilized reservists had started across Russia, in places including the Rostov region on the Ukrainian border and the Crimean Peninsula, which Russia seized from Ukraine in 2014. The Defense Ministry said on its Telegram channel that the training had also begun in the Kaliningrad enclave, which borders NATO members, both Poland and Lithuania. And Rostov, where Russian forces massed before invading Ukraine on February 24th, the ministry said all personnel had already been provided with the necessary clothing, received weapons, and started firing training. Russian President Vladimir Putin last week ordered Russia's first military mobilization since World War II, which could see hundreds of thousands of more men sent to fight in Ukraine. The ministry said that about 2,000 reservists had already received weapons in Crimea, which Moscow considers part of Russia after it seized the territory in 2014. The mobilization announcement has prompted many thousands of men of fighting age to try and leave Russia to avoid being called up to fight in Ukraine. Andrea Kendall Taylor is a senior fellow and director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for New American Security, and Will Pomerantz is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. They joined VOA Encounter host Carol Castiel this past weekend to discuss the significance of Ukraine's successful counteroffensives against Russia.
So, Andrea Kendall Taylor, you just got back from Kyiv. Let me get you to weigh in on where we are today at this particular juncture, with so many setbacks for Russia on the battlefield, retreating in the east, the horrific mass graves that we saw, evidence of war crimes and atrocities. The alliance seems to be holding so far. What would you like to tell us about what you've seen and how you see this juncture right now?
Thanks, Carol. It's great to be back. The trip to Kyiv that we took obviously predated the announcement. So we were there really at a remarkable time on the tail end of Ukraine's very remarkable success with its counteroffensive in the north. And that was really important for Ukraine because it was the first time that they were able to demonstrate their ability to go on the offensive and recapture territory. So that was a huge boost to Ukrainian fighters and also to Ukraine's Western backers, who now have evidence of Ukraine's ability to eventually win this war. So I think it's that context that we have to understand what Vladimir Putin has done. I think he could read very clearly that the long-term trends were not in Russia's favor, and he felt that he had to do something in order to stem the tide in this war. And so that's what I think we have to understand as the context for his announcements, which is the mobilization of, as you mentioned, at least 300,000. Many people are referring to this as a partial mobilization. But as many of us are digging into the text, partial is probably a misnomer. And this really gives Putin the ability to recruit and send into war for a very long time additional Russian fighters. I think the thing that I would underscore is, even though this is an escalation by President Putin, in my view, this doesn't fundamentally alter the trajectory of the war. I think the underlying trends continue to favor Ukraine. And so what these announcements do, in my opinion, is they will likely prolong the war, but I don't think that they change the fact that Ukraine eventually will come out on top.
Will Pomerantz, with your finger on the pulse of all things Russia, and of course, Vladimir Putin, I want to get you to weigh in on where we stand today regarding Putin's address this week, calling up a so-called partial mobilization, 300,000, which of course met with some protests. Do you agree with Andrea Kendall Taylor that all of this still does not necessarily alter the trajectory of the war, which is seemingly in favor of Ukraine, but that it will prolong things? Your take.
I agree with Andrea. And I do think that Ukraine has really waged a remarkable war against Russia. And I think that the question about mobilization really stresses that Ukraine has dealt a major blow to the Russian army, and that the fact that Putin has to mobilize troops, and it's unclear how prepared they are. It's quite unclear, you mentioned the protests, whether Russians even want to go and fight for this cause. So Putin has had to basically change his game plan, and it's unclear whether this actually can work. It's not clear whether Putin and the regions can actually get enough people to change the tide of the war, and it's unclear what their response will be. So I think Putin has his back against the wall, and the mobilization and the question about the referendum confirm that.
So back to you, Andrea Kendall Taylor, with regard to Will's comment that Putin has his back against the wall. Some analysts say that a cornered Putin is a more dangerous Putin. And of course, we say that in the context of the fact that he mentioned potential use of nuclear weapons. So let me get you to react to that statement. How seriously should we take it? He says, I'm not bluffing, but what is your response?
Well, I think it's hard just to slough it off, because as you've noted, the speech that he gave when he announced the Russian mobilization contained a lot of very direct and explicit nuclear saber rattling. I think the thing that was extremely concerning about his speech is that he appeared to, in many ways, change Russian nuclear doctrine, or at least talked in ways that contradict Russia's longstanding policy. You know, their current policy says that they can use a nuclear weapon when the existence of the state is threatened. But in this speech, Putin talked in much looser, more nebulous terms. He talked about using maximum tools to defend, quote unquote, Russia's territorial integrity, and also to protect the independence and freedom of Russians. And I think that term territorial integrity is especially concerning given the announcement of the referenda, which would illegally bring these Ukrainian territories into the Russian state. And that raises just so many questions, because we have to emphasize that Russia doesn't even control all of the four territories where these illegal and sham referenda will take place. So this does indeed raise a lot of questions about the potential for nuclear escalation. But I will tell you, Carol, the thing that I heard resoundingly in my trip to Ukraine in multiple conversations with different Ukrainians was that in their view, Russia's use of a nuclear weapon will not change the outcome of this war. It will not change how they fight this war. It will only increase the cost they have to incur to defeat Russia. And so, again, we don't want to downplay or just slough off these nuclear threats. We have to take them seriously. But I think Ukraine and the West also have to take a position where we cannot be deterred by these threats, because as many in the administration are pointing out, what's then to say that Russia can't at some later date claim that parts of Lithuania or Latvia or Estonia are part of the Russian state and extend his nuclear umbrella over those territories? So my sense is that we're in this very risky moment, but the pressure and the momentum is such that I think that people will be undeterred by Putin's nuclear threats.
Will Pomerantz, what is your take on this type of rhetoric, which Biden, of course, denounced vociferously in his address to the UN General Assembly? He denounced Putin's reckless rhetoric about the use of nuclear weapons in a direct violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. What do you think he's doing with this type of rhetoric?
I think Putin has weaponized all of Russia's assets. So they've imposed oil and gas restrictions. They have weaponized and limited the ability of Ukraine to export grain. And most importantly, they are attacking nuclear power stations in Ukraine. So I think that Putin, in terms of what his options are, I think that is his biggest attempt to basically try to blackmail the Europeans and say, blame the Ukrainians for attacking the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. And he'll say, you don't know which way the wind will blow. So therefore, you need to take off these sanctions and limit the restrictions on Russian travel and so forth. So I think it's an example of how Putin has weaponized all his assets. It's not working. And quite frankly, Putin really telegraphed all these moves in his constitutional amendments in 2020, where he asserted that the Russian state could defend Russians abroad. And he basically said that Russia cannot alienate any territory that is a part of the Russian Federation. So that if indeed he decides to annex Donetsk and Luhansk and other parts of Ukraine, he will assert that this is now a part of Russian territory and it cannot be negotiated. So I think Putin is stretching his role and his options.
That was Will Pomerantz, the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, as well as Andrea Kendall Taylor, senior fellow and director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for New American Security. They were speaking to Carol Castiel on VOA's Encounter Program, which you can find at voaafrica.com or in your favorite podcast player. And finally, Ukrainian war veterans who lost their limbs in the war are undergoing a unique form of therapy. It involves some help from some four-legged friends. VOA's Omalan Oshudlyak rounds us out.
On the front lines, he was Katun. That's how Private First Class Petro Apolsky introduces himself now. On the front lines, Apolsky drove a BMP-1, an amphibious-tracked infantry fighting vehicle. Today, his only mission is to saddle a horse named Dodo.
Horses are like cars. You need to service them, clean them, make them look good, and in return, they'll give you a ride.
Apolsky lost his leg in the Donbas region in May. He says he suffered serious internal injuries, but the doctors performed a miracle.
Doctors in Bakhmut-Donetsk region told me that I was born under a lucky star. Another 20 minutes of bleeding, and they would not have been able to save me. I now treat May 18th as my second birthday.
Although his body is healing, his mental struggles are more deep-rooted. And encourage them to try new experiences.
A rider gets to feel the horse, the rhythm of riding. He tries to balance in the saddle, relaxes a little, and that's when we start talking about a number of things. Family problems, plans for the future.
Riding instructor Alexandra Khandogina and her husband, a war veteran, decided to organize riding classes for veterans in 2018. Many of those who come here have lost a limb.
I just don't like the word rehabilitation at all. You just come here and have a great time riding a horse. Come visit us here. That's it. That's how I see it.
Khandogina and Chekmareva met before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. 4 years ago, in Prebirsk, Kyiv Oblast, Chekmareva founded a recreation center that welcomed veterans and frontline volunteers from fighting in the Donbas region, as well as children. After February 24, when the village was under Russian occupation, she fled and left five horses behind. Four of them survived and were later moved to the west of the country.
Our horses also have PTSD because they have experienced explosions, hunger, and resettlement. At first, they were very wary about returning to work.
Khandogina and Chekmareva say the damaged horses and damaged soldiers understand each other.
I think he can feel my mood and state of mind. I don't have a limb, but as I was on a horse today, I felt like I still had both.
Hell for both, men and beast. Amalena Shudlyak for VOA News, Lviv Region, Ukraine.
And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.